So let me just explain what undesigned coincidences are and how we can use them to corroborate biblical history, substantial veracity of the scriptures, and then I'll give some examples to show how they work in practice. So let's begin by talking about how they were first discovered. Well, how many of you recognize this man? This is William Paley, who is a very famous philosopher, Christian philosopher, who lived in the 1700s. And he's most famous for his book, Natural Theology, in which he develops his watchmaker thesis, which has come under some heavy scrutiny from skeptics and atheists. But he's also very famous, or he wrote some rather less famous books, one being Horae Polynae, which is basically an argument based on undesigned coincidences, and I'll explain what those are in a moment, between Book of Acts and the epistles of Paul, making an argument that Paul, in fact, wrote all 13 letters attributed to him in the New Testament, and also corroborating the substantial veracity or truth of the Book of Acts as well. And he also wrote another book subsequent to that called A View of the Evidence of Christianity, in which he develops his argument further, also looking at examples in the Gospels. Then in 1847, John James Blunt came along with this book on undesigned coincidences, both in the Old and New Testament, an argument of their veracity. And John James Blunt documented not only examples in the Gospels and between the Gospels, Acts, and external secular sources such as Josephus, but also examples in the Old Testament as well, arguing for the substantial veracity of Scripture. And so then this argument was largely forgotten about until this year, in 2017, when Dr. Lydia McGrew, who is an analytic philosopher in America, came out with this book, Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts, basically revitalizing Paley's argument and trying to recast them in view of modern scholarship. So what I want to do this evening, then, is to go through some of the examples of undesigned coincidences, explain what those are, and try to convince you that the Gospels and Acts in particular, I'm just going to cover the New Testament today, are substantially reliable. So how can we use undesigned coincidences to corroborate biblical history? Well, first of all, what is an undesigned coincidence? Well, sometimes two works by different authors interlock in such a way that it's unexpected if the story is being made up, or if one is copying from the other, or if both are copying from a common source. For example, one book may mention in passing a detail which explains in a haphazard or coincidental way some natural question that's raised by another account. So it's best explained by giving examples. So let me give some examples. Suppose that you are inventing a gospel story, and the setup for your miracle story is going to have to do with money and food. Now, which disciple might you pick to be involved in your setup for your miracle story? Well, you might pick Judas Iscariot because he was in charge of the money bag, or maybe Matthew the tax collector because he maybe knew a thing or two about money. So let's have a look at John chapter 6, where we have the setup for the feeding of the 5,000 miracle. We get to verse 5 of John chapter 6, and it says, "Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?'" Now this raises a question, a natural question, in the audience's mind. Why does Jesus turn to Philip in particular and ask him where we should send the people to buy bread? Philip's a fairly minor character in the Gospels. He doesn't come up too often. There's far more prominent disciples that you might pick for your miracle story. Why Philip in particular here? Then we go and continue reading, and we get to verses 8 and 9. It says, "One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, 'There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?'" Why does Andrew get involved in the reply here? Why does Andrew speak at this particular instance? Now flip over to another gospel, Luke chapter 9. Luke also tells us about the feeding of the 5,000. And he writes, "On their return, the apostles told him all they had done, and he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida. When the crowds learned it, they followed him, and he welcomed them and spoke to them of the kingdom of God and cured those who had need of healing." So notice that this event, then, we learn, is taking place in a town called Bethsaida. Now flip over to John chapter 12 and verse 21. Remember, this is 6 chapters removed from John chapter 6, where we learned about the feeding of the 5,000. John chapter 6, it says, "So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, 'Sir, we wish to see Jesus.'" In John chapter 1, verse 44, we also learn that Andrew is from Bethsaida. And so now we can put the pieces together to come up with an explanation for why Jesus turns to Philip in John chapter 6, and also why Andrew gets involved in the reply. Luke doesn't mention Philip in this context at all. He just mentions that Jesus spoke to the disciples. John doesn't mention Bethsaida as a setting of the miracle story. Only by putting them together can we understand why Jesus speaks to Philip in John 6:5. Philip is a local person. He knows where the shops are to buy bread. So Jesus turns to him and asks, where should we send these people to buy bread? And it also explains why Andrew gets involved in the reply. But the pieces, the jigsaw pieces you need to stitch together are gathered from Luke chapter 9, John chapter 6, and John chapter 12, which are completely unrelated parts, which fit together and provide a cogent explanation for why Jesus turns to Philip in John chapter 6. Make sense? But wait, there's more. There's also an account of this miracle in Mark 6. According to Mark 6, it says, and he said to them, come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going. They had no leisure even to eat. Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Now notice that there are people coming and going, so it indicates it's very busy. And also, it says, then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Now, about that green grass. The grass in Palestine is not green, right? It's brown. Throughout the entire year, except at a very narrow window of time during the spring, at the time of Passover, because of the elevated levels of rainfall. Now, if you go over to John chapter 6, John doesn't mention the people coming and going, indicating the busyness of the place, and he doesn't mention the grass is green. But he does mention in verse 4, the Jewish Passover festival was near. So again, we put the pieces together, and we have an explanation for why the grass is green and why there are people coming and going, according to Mark chapter 6. But there's more. In Matthew's account, in Matthew chapter 11, verse 21, he reports that the certain unrepentant cities were denounced by Jesus. He says, woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented a long time ago in sackcloth and ashes. What mighty works were done in Bethsaida? Nothing Matthew has reported up to this point gives us any clue. We find out, though, in Luke chapter 9, verse 10, that the feeding of the 5,000 took place in Bethsaida. Although Matthew 14 narrates the feeding of the 5,000, no mention is made of Bethsaida. And moreover, Matthew, who often arranges his material thematically rather than chronologically, tells a story of the feeding of the 5,000 in Matthew chapter 14. That's three chapters after the pronouncement of the woes on Bethsaida. So only by comparing Luke's account do we discover that the feeding actually took place before Jesus pronounces the woes to Bethsaida. So again, we have a jigsaw, we put the pieces together, and we come up with an explanation. But you might have wondered, when you're reading the story of the feeding of the 5,000, how they knew the number of people. How did they just know there were 5,000 people there? Did someone go and count them all, or give them each a number or something? Well, Matthew's account of the feeding of the 5,000 emphasizes that the number refers specifically to males. He says, and those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. The statement that about 5,000 men were fed also occurs in Mark 6:44, Luke 9:14, and John 6:10, though these Gospels do not add besides women and children. So how is this number calculated? Well, according to Mark 6, it says, then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass, so they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. Similarly, in Luke, it says, and he said to his disciples, have them sit down in groups of about 50 each. And they did so and had them all sit down. So no doubt having the crowd sorted into groups made it easier to distribute food among them, but it also made it easier to get an estimate for how many people there were. But you might still be wondering, how did they know how many men specifically there were besides women and children? Well, John, in his gospel, makes no mention of the groupings, but his account adds a crucial piece of the puzzle. He writes, Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down. The men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as many as they wanted. So Jesus tells the disciples to have the people sit down in groups, as Mark and Luke say, but it's the men who actually sit down, as John says. This explains how the number of men could be approximately counted. Perhaps the women and children were playing somewhere else or something, but the men, it says in John, sat down, although John makes no mention of the groupings. So now we have an explanation for how they could calculate or estimate how many men there approximately there were besides women and children. So what is the significance then of undesigned coincidences? Well, one undesigned coincidence might be an accident, like having two unrelated pieces of a jigsaw fit together just by chance. But if we discover numerous undesigned coincidences crisscrossing the documents, it becomes ridiculous to insist that they are all just accidental. So let's go through some more examples in the Gospels of undesigned coincidences. Consider this one in John chapter 12, and the first two verses. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead, so they gave him a dinner for him there. And then the next day we read, the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, crying out, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." So notice that the timestamp given here is 6 days before the Passover. Yes, John is the only gospel that gives us that timestamp at this point. And so he comes 6 days before the Passover. Lazarus and Mary and Martha prepare a dinner for him there in Bethany. And then the following day, he rides into Jerusalem, and you've got the triumphal entry scenario. Now, I want to suggest that we can actually find each of these 6 days in the Gospel of Mark, even though Mark does not give us a timestamp that this is 6 days before the Passover. Now, let's turn over to Mark. Mark chapter 11. Now, this is the parallel account in Mark. Now, when they drew near to Jerusalem, to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the village in front of you, and immediately as you enter it, you will find a colt tied, on which no one has ever sat. Untie it and bring it." Now, my argument here is going to assume that Jesus first came to Bethany the day before, possibly towards the evening, and that this text is merely alluding to the fact that Bethany and Bethphage are close to Jerusalem, mark the approach to Jerusalem and the approximate location from which Jesus sent his disciples to get the colt. So Mark seems to actually telescope the account. So according to John, he arrives in Bethany 6 days before the Passover, and then the following day he goes to get the colt. But according to Mark, it just mentions he arrives in Bethany and he gets his disciples to go fetch the colt. Now, how could I support this from Mark's gospel? That this is the same the same scenario applies. Well, the events described in Mark 11 seem to begin early in the day. They fetch the donkey. You've got the triumphal entry. Then Mark says that Jesus entered the temple and looked all around at everything in verse 11. So I think we're quite safe in assuming that Jesus sends his disciples to go fetch the colt the following day after he's arrived in Bethany, even from Mark's gospel. So then we can assume that he goes to get the colt. He sends his disciples to get the colt 5 days before Passover. Okay, 5 days before Passover. If John is correct in telling us that he arrives in Bethany 6 days before Passover. So, in Mark chapter 11, verse 11, it says, "And he entered Jerusalem and went to the temple, and when he looked around at everything, as it was already light, he went out to Bethany with the 12." So this then can be taken as the conclusion or the end of 5 days before the Passover. This is the evening, right? The end of 5 days before the Passover. Then we turn over and we get as far as verse 12. It says, "On the following day, when they came to Bethany, he was hungry," and they've got the cursing of the fig tree. That occurs 4 days before Passover, if John is correct. And then here we've got, in verse 19, "When evening came, they went out of the city." So that's the end of 4 days before the Passover. Then we continue, and we get to Mark chapter 11. "As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots." And then you've got the Olivet Discourse, which takes place on the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is midway between the temple and Bethany, where he's staying. And so we can assume that this is on the way back to Bethany in the evening. So this is now the end of 3 days before the Passover. Now, what happens when we get to Mark chapter 14? It was now 2 days before the Passover. It calibrates perfectly. And so again, we have an undesigned coincidence between what John said in John chapter 12, it was 6 days before the Passover, and it calibrates exactly with when Mark says it was 2 days before the Passover. That is a kind of pattern which is very expected in a work of history where someone is recounting real events, but is very surprising if the gospel accounts are fictional or based on events that never happened. Here's another example. In Matthew chapter 10, it gives you a listing of the 12 apostles. It says, the names of the 12 apostles were these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Now, why does Matthew choose to pair the disciples like this? Why does he list the names of the disciples in pairs? Well, the explanation is given in Mark chapter 6, verse 7. And he called the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. Only Mark has this detail. But Mark 3:16 through 19, which lists the disciples, does not group them into pairs. And although Matthew lists and mentions the sending out of the disciples by Jesus, he doesn't mention that they were sent out two by two. So again, we've got this dovetailing between Matthew and Mark, supporting the veracity of the gospel narratives. Here's another example. In Mark 14, verse 58, Jesus is before Caiaphas, the high priest, at his interrogation. And the false witnesses step forward to accuse Jesus. And they say, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy the temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I'll build another, not made with hands.'" Right? And then later, when he's on the cross, in Mark 15, verse 29, those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days." Now, notice that nothing in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew and Mark, which give this accusation, nothing in the Synoptic Gospels provides a pretext for this accusation. Jesus never said he would destroy a man-made temple and rebuild it in 3 days. And that was a pretty serious allegation. And it's not the kind of thing in first century Judea they make jokes about destroying the Temple of Solomon. Right? And you got this unexplained allusion in the trial narratives in Matthew and Mark, with no explanation as to where they're getting this from. But it seems that it's not something that's been invented out of whole cloth, but rather like a garbled version of something that Jesus really said, especially in view of the reference to the 3 days, which is often associated with Jesus' predictions concerning his resurrection. Now flip over to John chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. So this Jew said to Jesus, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And of course, he's speaking of his body. And it says that when he was raised from the dead, then the disciples remembered the words that Jesus had spoken, and they believed the scriptures. So John gives us the original statement of Jesus, but not its use as an accusation. The Synoptic Gospels give us the accusation, but not the original statement. So neither of these is copied from the other. Again, this has got a mark of verisimilitude. It has a ring of truth or veracity. Here's another example of an undesigned coincidence. In Matthew chapter 14, speaking of Herod speaking to his servants, Herod Antipas, at that time Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him." Now this raises two natural questions. Firstly, why is Herod talking about this matter to his servants? And secondly, how would Matthew know what Herod had said to his servants? Right? So the explanation then is given in Luke chapter 8. Let's see, lost the slide there. In Luke chapter 8, we read, "Soon afterwards, he went on through cities and villages, proclaiming and bringing the good news of the kingdom of God, and the 12 were with him, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager, and Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their means." So Herod's household manager was married to one of the disciples of Jesus. So that explains both why Herod was talking about this matter to his servants, and it also explains how Matthew could come to know what Herod had said to his servants. Another example of an undesigned coincidence. Here's another example. This is from Luke chapter 23. This is when Jesus is at his trial before Pilate. And it says, "The whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king.' And Pilate asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And he answered him, 'You have said so.' Then Pilate said to the chief priests and to the crowd, 'I find no guilt in this man.'" What? So he's just declared himself to be king of the Jews, and Pilate finds him not guilty? So you're a king then, Jesus, no problem there. Is that really what's going on there? Whereas we flip over to John's account of the same event, and we read, "So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' Jesus answered him, 'Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?' Pilate answered, 'Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?' Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." And so at this point, presumably Pilate considers Jesus to be rather a religious nutcase and rather harmless, and so he says, "Oh, I find no guilt in this man. He just means a spiritual king, not a literal king of the Jews in a physical sense." So again, you've got this dovetailing between John and the synoptics supporting its truth. Here's another example. This is Joseph of Arimathea when he asks Pilate for the body of Jesus. It says, "When evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus." Now, why does Mark here choose to emphasize or highlight the courageousness of Joseph of Arimathea? Right? There's no explanation given in Mark as to why he emphasizes or highlights the courageousness of Joseph. Now flip over to John chapter 19, the parallel account, and he doesn't highlight the courageousness of Joseph, but he does say, "After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus." So now we understand why Mark highlights the courageousness of Joseph, because he had previously been a secret disciple, but only privately for fear of the Jews. Here's another example. This is another form of undesignedness called the uniformity of expressive silence. And there's one example of this in the New Testament, which is, and this is basically a form of undesignedness which can arise when we examine cases where information is assumed by the author, although not explicitly spelled out. And this may be called uniformity of expressive silence, repeated omissions that have meaning. So let me give you an example. Where's Joseph in the gospel accounts? Jesus' father Joseph appears only in the childhood narratives in Matthew and Luke. He's also briefly alluded to in John 1:45. "We have found him, of whom Moses in the law and also prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And also in John 6, verse 42, they said, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he now say, 'I've come down from heaven'?" The last we see of Joseph is during the trip to Jerusalem when Jesus is 12 years old in Luke chapter 2. Nowhere are we told what happened to Joseph. There is silent presumption of his death without any positive affirmation of that fact. And what's even more striking is that Joseph is conspicuously absent from the narrative even when Jesus' family are conspicuously present, that is his mother and his brothers. So in Mark chapter 3, for example, it says, "Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again, so that they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying he is out of his mind. And his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And the crowd was sitting around them, and they said to him, 'Your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you.'" And he said, he answered them, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And so on. Here we have Jesus' mother and brothers alluded to, and they're conspicuously present, even when Joseph's father is conspicuously missing from the narrative. So it raises the question, where is Joseph? In Mark chapter 6, it says, they say, is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James, and Joseph, and Judas, and Simon, are not his sisters here with us? Right? It doesn't mention that Jesus' father is there with them also. In John chapter 2 and verse 12, it says, "After this, he went out down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days." But where's Joseph? In John chapter 19, verse 27, "Then he said to the disciple," this is the disciple whom Jesus loved when he's on the cross, he says, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home. This is speaking about Mary, his own mother. Why does he request that the beloved disciple take care of his own mother, Mary? Or where's Joseph? Why is Joseph not taking care of his mother? Then in Acts chapter 1, it says that all the disciples are praying. It says, "All these with one accord were devoting themselves to prayer, together with the woman and Mary, the mother of Jesus and his brothers." Or where's Joseph? So this is the kind of pattern that you expect in history. It has a mark of verisimilitude to suggest that the author knows something more about the circumstances than he lets slip of his pen, that he actually communicates in his narrative. And that is a mark of history And it's more expected or less surprising on history than it is on fiction. So there's also examples of undesigned coincidences between the Gospels and external secular sources, including Josephus and Tacitus. Let's have a look at some of those. In Matthew chapter 2, in verse 22, we have the sole mention of Herod Archelaus. He's only mentioned once in Scripture. But when Joseph heard, this is when he's coming back from Egypt, but when Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Then after being warned by God in a dream, he left for the regions of Galilee. Now, why is Joseph afraid of Archelaus? Well, if we flip over to Flavius Josephus, who was a first century Jewish historian, in his Antiquities of the Jews, in volume 17, he tells us that the domain of Herod the Great was divided among his sons, with Archelaus having authority in Judea, but not in Galilee, which was governed by his younger brother, Herod Antipas. We also know that Archelaus had acquired quite a bloody reputation. So in one scenario, according to Josephus, at the time of Passover, and this is about the same time that Joseph would have been returning from Egypt, at the time of Passover, basically there was a riot among the Jews, and basically the pilgrims, picked up boulders or stones, and they stoned to death some of the soldiers. And then they picked up their sacrifices and ran to the Jewish temple and basically said, I'm on base, can't touch me. And so Archelaus, Josephus tells us, was absolutely enraged. And he sent his entire army upon the Jewish temple. He surrounded the temple with the horsemen and sent the infantry into the temple. He instructed the horsemen, don't let anyone leave or enter the temple. And with his infantry, he slaughtered 3,000 Jews inside the Jewish temple and announced that Passover is cancelled, return to your homes. And so you can imagine Joseph, on his way back from Egypt, encountering those fleeing pilgrims coming out of Judea, and learning about what's just happened, and being very afraid of Archelaus, and so he returns by the region of Galilee, rather than going into Judea. So again, you've got this backstory, which then corroborates the story in the Bible. Here's another example. This is actually a case where skeptical scholars have argued there's a case of historical error in the Gospels. In Mark chapter 10, verse 12, Jesus gives instructions concerning adultery and divorce. And he says, if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, the Jewish law made provision for a man to divorce his wife, but not for a woman to divorce her husband. So was Mark a Gentile who here betrays his ignorance of Jewish law? Or is he deliberately changing Jesus' teaching to make it relevant for a Roman audience? Well, here's a critic stating the objection. This is from the Gospel of Mark, the commentary by John Donohue and Daniel Harrington, who are critics or skeptics. It says, this sentence is generally regarded as an addition to Jesus' teaching that was made to address situations relating to Roman legal practice whereby a woman could initiate divorce proceedings. But then we turn to Flavius Josephus, our old friend. And Flavius Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, volume 18, mentions that Herodias took it upon herself to confound the laws of her country and divorced her first husband in order to marry Herod Antipas. Now, Herod Antipas was Tetrarch of Galilee, the very place where Jesus was then teaching. And so we have, again, a backstory to the teaching that Jesus is giving. What about the death of John the Baptist in Mark chapter 6, verse 27? We read that Herod Antipas sent a military officer, that's what the Greek word speculatura means, to execute John the Baptist. Now, why does he not just use a civil executioner? Well, the answer is found in Josephus in his Antiquities of the Jews, who also mentions the execution of John the Baptist. And he mentions that Herod was at war at the time with his former father-in-law, Aretas IV, king of the Nabataeans. So that explains why he had a military officer carry out the execution. He was at Machaerus on a military campaign, not at his palace in Galilee. So again, we have an undesigned coincidence between the Gospels and an external secular source. Here's another example. In the book of Acts, when Luke tells us of the riot in Ephesus, he reports that the city clerk tells the crowd that there are proconsuls. Now, a proconsul is a Roman authority to whom a complaint may be taken, and normally there was only one proconsul at a time. But just at that particular time, there seems to have been two as a result of the assassination of Silenus, the previous proconsul,
by poisoning in the fall of AD 54 by the two imperial stewards at the urging of Nero's mother. This event is independently documented by Tacitus in his Annals of Imperial Rome. Indeed, Luke's accuracy has allowed historians to date the event, which Luke narrates with incredible precision, since we know when Silenus was poisoned. Also in the book of Acts, in chapter 5, it says, the high priest rose up, and all they that were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and were filled with indignation. Now, Luke here intimates that the high priest was a Sadducee, which is a character one would not have expected to meet with in that station. The circumstances, however, remarkable as it is, was not without examples. For example, there's some examples from Josephus there where that was the case. Another thing to do with the high priest is that according to Matthew 26:3, the chief priests, plural, and the elders of the peoples gathered in the palace of the high priests, whose name was Caiaphas. Now, wait a minute. Wasn't there just meant to be one high priest? Why, if you're inventing a story, you would presumably just invent one high priest. And why are there two high priests rather than one? If you know the Old Testament, you know there was only one high priest at the time. But it gets worse than that, because according to John 11, verse 49, but one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, wait a minute, wasn't the office of high priest a lifelong occupation? Why was he just high priest for that year? Well, that Caiaphas was high priest and high priest throughout the reign of Pontius Pilate, and consequently at this time appears in Josephus in his Antiquities of the Jews. Caiaphas was made high priest by Valerius Gratus, who was the predecessor of Pontius Pilate, and was removed from his office by Batilius, president of Syria, after Pilate was sent away out of the province of Judea. Here's a text from Antiquities, volume 18. Gratus gave the high priesthood to Simon, son of Caiaphas. He, having enjoyed this honor not above a year, was succeeded by Joseph, who is called Caiaphas, which then illuminates why he mentions Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. After this, Gratus went away for Rome, having been 11 years in Judea, and Pontius Pilate was his successor. Of the removal of Caiaphas from his office, Josephus likewise afterwards informs us and connects it with a circumstance which fixes the time to a date subsequent to the determination of Pilate's government. He says, Vitellius ordered Pilate to repair to Rome, and after that went up himself to Jerusalem, and then gave directions concerning several matters, and having done these things, he took away the priesthood from the high priest Joseph, who was called Caiaphas. So Gratus actually removed Ananus as high priest in AD 16, and has stated the line of other high priests, one of whom was Joseph Caiaphas. And what the Jews actually did was they recognized the Roman institution of their high priest, but also continued to recognize the God-appointed high priest, who in this case was Ananus. So another example to do with the high priest in Acts 23, those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. Now it turns out that Ananias, of whom this is spoken, was in truth not the high priest, but he was acting in the office in that assumed capacity. The case was that he had formerly held the office and had been deposed, and the persons who succeeded him then had been murdered, that another was not yet appointed to the station, and that during the vacancy he had of his own authority taken upon himself the discharge of the office. That's from Josephus. The singular situation of the high priesthood took place during the interval between the death of Jonathan, who was murdered by order of Felix, and the accession of Ishmael, who was invested with the high priesthood by Agrippa. And precisely in this interval it happened that the Apostle Paul was apprehended and brought before the Jewish council. So finally then, I want to look at some examples between the book of Acts and the epistles of Paul. Here's an example in Galatians 1:18. Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him 15 days. Now, why does Paul have such a short visit to Jerusalem? He says he saw none of the other apostles, just James, the Lord's brother, right? Why does he not stay and extend his visit to make time to see the other apostles? Well, why was Paul's visit cut short? The answer is given in Acts 9, verse 29. And he spoke and disputed against the Hellenists, but they were seeking to kill him. And when the brothers learned this, they brought him down to Caesarea and sent him off to Tarsus. No further comment is necessary. Here's another example, 1 Corinthians 4:17. That's why I sent you Timothy. So Timothy, according to Paul, has already been sent when he's writing his letter to the Corinthian church. But in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 10, he says, when Timothy comes. So he evidently expects this letter to arrive before Timothy arrives in Corinth. We therefore infer that Timothy must have taken some indirect route to Corinth. In Acts 19:22, we see that he did take such a route, going up and around through Macedonia. So there's Ephesus there, where he's writing to the Corinthian church. And we know that because he sends greetings from Aquila and Priscilla, whom he met in Corinth. They traveled with him as far as Ephesus. So he's writing from Ephesus, and that's where Corinth is, the capital of Achaia in Greece. And Timothy goes up to Troas and up through Macedonia and around to Corinth, where presumably he sent his letter, the more direct route, over the Aegean Sea. So that explains this detail, these two passages in 1 Corinthians. What about Paul's ministry change in Acts 18? So we read about him getting acquainted with Aquila and Priscilla in Corinth, and it says, because he was of the same trade, that is, they were tent makers, he stayed with them and they were working, by trade they were tent makers, and he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. Wait a minute, he just started devoting himself entirely to the word? So his ministry model prior to this was that he was working during the week, and then in the Sabbath, he was going to reason and debate with the Jews in the synagogues. But then when Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word. Right? He's now a full-time minister. So what caused the shift from Paul's working all week and doing evangelism on the Sabbath to his devoting himself completely to the word? It apparently had something to do with the arrival of Silas and Timothy from Macedonia. The question is answered for us in 2 Corinthians 11. He writes, I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone. For the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way. So the brothers that came from Macedonia, Silas and Timothy specifically, brought supplies or financial resources. And Luke may not even have known the explanation for this. He just observes Paul changing his ministry model. Yet the explanation is provided for us in 2 Corinthians 11. Another example. In Acts 15, Paul and Barnabas go on a second missionary journey. And the purpose of this journey was to check up on the converts of the first journey to see how they're doing. And there's a big fallout or split between Paul and Barnabas because John Mark, who had accompanied them previously on a mission, had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia on a mission trip. And so Paul doesn't want Mark to go with them a second time so that he can betray them again. But Barnabas is quite keen for Mark to accompany them. So this causes a sharp split, a sharp disagreement between Paul and Barnabas, and they end up going their separate ways at that point. Now, why is Barnabas so keen to take Mark with them, even though he's withdrawn from them previously in Pamphylia? Well, the question is answered for us in Colossians 4, verse 10. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. So Mark was a family relation of Barnabas. He was his cousin. And so the author of Colossians is not inventing this in order to try and explain Acts, because there's no indication in Colossians there ever was a split or a disagreement between Mark and Barnabas and Paul, right? So he's not inventing it to try and explain it, but this does nonetheless dovetail with the book of Acts. Here's another example. In 1 Thessalonians, Paul mentions that he left Timothy behind in order to serve the Thessalonian Christians. He writes, therefore, when we could bear it no longer, we were willing to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother, and God's co-worker in the gospel of Christ, to establish and exhort you in your faith so that no one be moved by these afflictions. For you yourselves know that we are destined for this. For when we were with you, we kept telling you beforehand that we were to suffer affliction, just as it has come to pass, and just as you know. For this reason, when I could bear it no longer, I sent to learn about your faith, for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you, and our labor would be in vain. We were willing to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy. But now that Timothy has come to us from you, and has brought us the good news of your faith, and love, and reported that you always remember us kindly, and long to see us, as we long to see you. So from 1 Thessalonians 3, the text I just read, it appears that Paul was alone at Athens, having sent Timothy to Thessalonica, and that Timothy joined him afterwards. In Acts 17, verse 14, it agrees with this, except that instead of being sent to Thessalonica, Timothy was left at Berea. So Paul had been in Thessalonica, and then because he and Timothy were harassed by the Jews, they go to Berea, And then the Jews from Thessalonica come to Berea to harass Paul and Timothy. And so then Paul leaves Timothy in Berea, and he meanwhile goes to Athens. So he's in Athens alone. And that's the account here in the book of Acts. So how do we integrate the accounts? Well, Berea, because the account in Acts leaves Paul's separation from Timothy unexplained. Now, Berea is less than 50 miles west of Thessalonica. Paul left Berea for Athens in haste because the Jews from Thessalonica came to Berea to stir up the people against him. Under the circumstances, Paul was worried about the Christians in Thessalonica, and so he therefore commissioned Timothy to go back to Thessalonica to check on the church there. Luke in Acts has just omitted the sending of Timothy from Berea to Thessalonica, thus leaving the cause of his separation from Paul unexplained. So again, you have the dovetailing between Acts and 1 Thessalonians. Now, undesigned coincidences not only support the veracity of the book of Acts, but they also support the Pauline authorship, really, of all 13 letters of Paul, including the ones that are disputed among scholars. So one of the works of Paul that's disputed among scholars is the pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. It's one of the most, probably the most disputed works of the New Testament in terms of their authorship, at least as far as Paul's epistles are concerned. And 2 Timothy 3:20, this is an argument for that Paul wrote the pastoral epistles. 2 Timothy 3:20, Erastus remained at Corinth. Now we can infer from this that Corinth was most likely Erastus's hometown. In Romans 16:23, it says, Gaius, who is host to me and to the whole church, greets you. Erastus, city treasurer, and her brother Quartus greet you. So wherever Paul is writing Romans from, that's where Erastus is city treasurer. Can we establish then, on independent grounds, where Paul wrote Romans from? Well, if you go over to 2 Corinthians 9, he mentions a certain collection being prepared by the churches in Macedonia and Achaia. It's already been collected in Macedonia, and he wants the Christians in Achaia, where Corinth is capital, ready with the collection by the time he comes, lest he should be humiliated. Then, back in Romans, the collection has been prepared, according to Romans 15. The collection has now been prepared, it's been received, it's ready to be delivered to the saints in Jerusalem. And when he's delivered what's been collected, he says, I'll leave for Spain by way of you, speaking to the Romans. And so we can infer that he's writing from Corinth and Achaia, having just received the collection. And so then that dovetails with Romans, which says that Erastus, the city treasurer, preached you, and also dovetails with 2 Timothy, Erastus remained at Corinth. One more example. Colossians 4:9, Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of you. So that suggests that Onesimus was a fellow Colossian. In Philemon, we have the connection between Onesimus is from, but we have the connection between Onesimus and Philemon, and also a connection between Philemon and Archippus. Colossians 4:17 says, and say to Archippus. So we have a message that he wants to deliver to Archippus. So I'll see what this one. So we have this dovetailing between the Colossians and Philemon, suggesting that Paul is the author of both. So in conclusion then, undesigned coincidences cumulatively evidence that the Gospels and Acts are based on the testimony of eyewitnesses as well as their substantial trustworthiness. And therefore, since we can connect the Gospels and Acts to the testimony of eyewitnesses, we must take seriously the statements in the Gospels and Acts concerning the resurrection to come from apostolic testimony, including their polymodal character, involving not just sight, but touching, physical contact, group conversation, and so on. And being extended across 40 days, so not one briefly confusing episode. And so it's powerful evidence also for the veracity of the resurrection of Jesus. So I'll conclude with that and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to do a test on that. Just to quickly see what you recall, and those of you who do not get more than 50% goes to hell. So any questions? I know it was quite obvious and self-explanatory, but if there's any questions, I mean, I'll be really surprised if there is, because it was obvious. But any questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and they said, prophesy unto us who is beating you.
Yeah.
Right? And we don't know why they would say that to him.
Yeah.
Right? But we go to another gospel and we find out he was blindfolded.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we know why they were asking him to prophesy, because he obviously didn't see.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's often used as another example of an undesigned coincidence. The reason I don't use that, and by the way, there's a lot more undesigned coincidences that would take several hours to go through them all. Yeah, but that particular example I find to be one of the slightly weaker ones, because you can explain that by incomplete copying, because the gospel which mentions the blindfolding also mentions Jesus and being asked who beat you, who prophesied to us. So you could just say, well, one of the Gospels just omitted that detail. Whereas the ones that I find particularly compelling are the ones where you've got one piece of the puzzle in one Gospel and the other piece of the puzzle in the other Gospel, and you can't explain it by incomplete copying in that way. Yeah.
Whilst we're waiting for the next one, let's say you do not have an IQ of 140 and you do not have friends, and you're not interested in these kind of things, but you sort of want to take Jesus' claim seriously. Yeah. What's the significance of this? So in other words, if you have to conclude, why is this exciting from a, let's say, a non-historian perspective?
It's exciting because it demonstrates the substantial veracity of the Gospels and Acts, and also is part of the argument, part of the cumulative argument for the traditional authorship of the four Gospels, and it also confirms the authenticity of all 13 letters of Paul. And one of the reasons that it's exciting for me is that it relates to the arguments for the resurrection of Jesus, because it shows that the Gospels and Acts are linked to the testimony of the apostles, and so we have to take seriously what they say concerning the resurrection as coming from the apostolic testimony.
So if you, you're not only a historian, you're not only interested in the history about it, you're interested in how this relates to a relationship with Jesus.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure whether you relate to this in the same way that I did, but as you were busy, I thought, when I sometimes read the Gospels or read the narratives, it's got such miraculous claims that you sometimes think that you're not busy reading a book of history. You sometimes fall back and think, yeah, this is nice, but it doesn't read like history. Mm-hmm. And maybe what you did tonight reminds me of the fact that, no, this is too precise, this is too coincidental mm-hmm. to just be fabricated. And it makes me excited about the miraculous claims, again, because I'm saying, whoa, this is history. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of what you want Christians or just people to experience?
If you have a loaf of bread and you chop it up here, 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 you chop it up in 100 different ways, it becomes rather ridiculous to speculate that perhaps all the mold exists and the parts we just haven't chopped at yet. And there's and so when everything that we can cross check concerning the Gospels actually turns out to be corroborated, then I think it's an unwarranted speculation that, well, maybe just the parts that we haven't checked yet are the ones where the mold exists or where Hossud is. There are non-designed coincidences that pertain both to the to non-miraculous elements of the text as well as the miraculous aspects of the text.
When you read the histories of the first century, like Joseph Flavius and mm-hmm. and others in the Greek and Roman authors, and even the earlier and later ones, you will find that in those books they often have miraculous events described in them. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it tells me that the Gospels are actually in that tradition, and that they are first century documents, and that one should not doubt that they are written early and not late.
Yeah. Was there a question in there, or okay, just a comment? I mean, in terms of just to piggyback on that, there just in terms of the author, the dating of the Gospels, I think the Gospels are indeed early and not late. I date the Book of Acts to around 61 or 62 A.D. because there's no mention of the Great Fire broke out in Rome in AD 64, no mention of the persecution under the Emperor Nero.
no mention of the death of Peter, James, Paul, etc. in the mid-60s, no mention of the siege in Jerusalem, 66 to 70, or its culmination in the destruction of the temple in AD 70, etc. So that pushes Luke back even earlier than that, since Acts is the sequel to Luke. And also, Luke is quoted from in 1 Timothy 5:18 verbatim as scripture, and I maintain the pastorals are indeed Pauline. So then, since Luke is probably the latest of the synoptics, that then pushes Mark and Matthew back even further still. So we have very good reason to date the Gospels quite early. Yeah.
Thanks for the talk. The undesigned differences in the Gospels are sometimes more prominent or more commonly discussed. And I know Mike Lacona did something on that. I think he might have mentioned it when he was here as well. But could you maybe go through some of the thinking behind, okay, sure, there are some coincidences, but there also seem to be glaring differences. And how would you, it might be a talk on its own, but.
Yeah, that's I actually do have a presentation on that alone. But,
good, yeah, like that, a short version.
So, yeah, differences between the Gospels. I mean, one has to look at those on a case-by-case basis. So let me find an example. Take, for example, in Luke chapter 24, where you have one of the post-resurrection appearances, and as Jesus appears to the 12, and then you've got the ascension at Bethany, right? Whereas if you flip over to John's account, he mentions there's an appearance to the 11, which seems to be the same appearance as the appearance to the 12 in Luke 24. And then later, there's another appearance with Thomas present. And so that's the appearance of the 12. And then, and so you've got an apparent discrepancy between the Gospels, because Luke seems to make it appear there's just one appearance to the 12. But once you understand, if you go to the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 1, and we read that the resurrection appearances took place over a span of 40 days, and Jesus appeared giving many convincing proofs that he was alive. Now we see that Luke actually does understand that there were multiple appearances over a 40-year span, but in Luke 24, for the purpose of space, he telescopes and he collapses them all into one. So that's just one example. I mean, it would take a while to go through all the examples that have been given, but yeah.
Anything else?
Okay. It is one over there, yeah.
This arises completely out of curiosity. You focus mainly on the New Testament and not the Old. Is there a reason for that?
Just time. In fact, on Thursday, I did an hour and a half version of this where I talked about New Testament examples and Old Testament examples. So there's, just very briefly, I'll give you one Old Testament example if you want. Okay, I'll give you one Old Testament example. So in 2 Samuel 15, we have the story of King Absalom. King David and his son Absalom conspiring against King David and rebelling against him. And we read that Absalom sends for Ahithophel the Gilonite. Now, who's Ahithophel the Gilonite? Ahithophel is David's most trusted counselor, right? So in 2 Samuel 16, it says that in those days, Ahithophel's counsel was so well trusted by David that when David consulted him, it was though he was consulting the word of God, right? That's how much he trusted Ahithophel's counsel. So then the question arises, why does Absalom think to himself, I'm going to rebel against my father, the king, so I'll send for his most trusted advisor, and he'll surely join me in the conspiracy. And why is Ahithophel so quick to turn on David? Flip over 8 chapters to 2 Samuel chapter 23. We read a listing of the bodyguards of King David. It's a long list. There's 37 names in that list. Two names stand out. One is Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. The other is Uriah the Hittite. Now, Uriah the Hittite should be a familiar name. Go back to 2 Samuel 11, and David is on his palace roof, and he sees Bathsheba bathing, and he lusts after her. And he asks who this woman is, and he's told, this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, we learn from chapter 23 that Eliam is the son of Ahithophel, which then we can then infer that Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba. So now we have an explanation for why Ahithophel is so quick to turn on David. And also it explains why in chapter 16, Ahithophel counsels Absalom to go and sleep with his father's concubines and pitches a tent for Absalom on the roof of the palace, just where David's lustful eye first caught Bathsheba. But that's never spelled out in the text. You have to do the detective work of putting the puzzle pieces together. So there we have another example of an undesigned coincidence in the Old Testament.
Anything else?